Hello, good evening. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'll be your host again this evening as we continue our special coverage of COVID-19 here in our community. On this Health Matters, Dr. Keith Scott, Professor of Pediatrics and Surgery and Medicine here at LSU in Shreveport, will let us know the latest on clinical trials for the treatment of COVID-19 here at LSU Health System in Shreveport. Also with us tonight, we have Dr. Jennifer Singh, Assistant Professor of Internal Medicine at the Feisweiler Cancer Center, who is also board certified in lifestyle medicine, and she will inform us about the mobile testing that has been performed here and how it's being utilized to test for coronavirus in some of our most at-risk communities. I want to invite our listeners to call with any questions or comments about this topic tonight. That number for your call is 1-800-552-8502 or via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Scott and Singh, thank you guys so much for joining us via Zoom tonight.
Thank you so much for having us.
So, Dr. Scott, let's start on the research side. I understand the testing has progressed along, but we're also seeing, you know, a number of clinical trials that have progressed here at LSU in Shreveport. Explain to us again what is going on with the clinical trials, in particular nitric oxide. We've talked about that trial a couple of times so far.
Well, the nitric oxide, for your listeners that may have not heard before, is a gas that has been around for a long time to treat premature babies and pediatric patients to help them oxygenate when they had respiratory failure. What we found in the first, the SARS outbreak, was some of those patients that received nitric oxide actually did better. And so when SARS-CoV-2 came out, or COVID-19, one of the things that we did was partnered with Mass General at Harvard, Beth Israel at Harvard, UAB in Birmingham, and in Sweden, to see if giving this gas at very high doses not only would help oxygen, but what it seemed to happen is it inactivated or perhaps killed the virus. So that's what we're studying. We're doing it in two different trials, maybe a third. The first is patients that are very, very ill. We give it a very high dose continuously for up to 28 days. And the less severe, so someone that may come in and just be on oxygen and maybe just short of breath or have a cough, or high fever, we give it a very extremely high dose twice a day. And we're seeing if this would actually help in the mild cases, hopefully prevent them from progressing to severe. In the severe, hopefully get them off the ventilator quicker. We've had two data safety monitoring boards since we started the trial. We have about 75 people totally in the trial, and all they keep coming back and saying it's safe, keep going. Anecdotally, it seems to be making a difference, but we have to study it. So we have that trial. We have another trial that we're looking at, which is healthcare workers that have done a shift in the COVID unit, that they can leave their shift and then get 5 to 10 minutes of nitric oxide before they leave. And we're hoping to see if that would prevent them from acquiring it after working in that environment for 12 hours. So we have that. We have probably 7 or 8 other trials going on at the same time. We have one that's an inhaled drug that seems to cleave the protein that the virus needs to attach to a cell. And we've had one person enrolled in that. We're trying to get 6 to 8. We have other ones looking at blocking different types of cytokines. So like I said, there's 7 or 8 trials going on, and we have this very cohesive COVID-19 research group, and we're trying to look at all avenues, any way we can attack this. We're trying to find a way to do it.
That's great up-to-date information. So I understand you have two trials going on. Is that what I heard? You've got a trial that's designed to treat the more severe patients, maybe patients who already need a mechanical ventilator, and then patients who are less severe who you're looking at maybe preventing them from needing a mechanical ventilator?
You're absolutely correct. The one that's in the severe, what our hope is that we can get them off the ventilator sooner. The less severe we're hoping that this gas will keep them from progressing. So we stop it in its tracks and they don't go on to need mechanical ventilation. That's, for the most part, one of the more exciting points of this, because I think that's where this gas may make a big difference.
This is listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. We are discussing the COVID-19 pandemic. You can call with questions or comments at 1-800-552-8502 or tweet at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Jennifer Singh is also with us tonight. Dr. Singh, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we're going to go back and forth. I know your emphasis is on testing, and then Dr. Scott's emphasis is basically on trials and treatment. So if you guys will indulge me, listeners as well as our guests, we're going to go back and forth between testing and treating so that we can cover the spectrum of the illness. So from your standpoint, how did you get involved with mobile testing? We were talking a little bit before the show started, you know, with what your clinical practice is and mobile health. And you know, with regards to COVID-19, I know in my practice, it's definitely accelerated telehealth. I mean, without question.
Right.
So do you think COVID-19 has accelerated mobile health, and how is that working out for you?
Well, it has accelerated mobile health for us. We've been very lucky to already have been in a position where we had structure in place for mobile health. We already had vans. So maybe not something that can be reproduced everywhere. Not everyone quite has that luxury, but thankfully we already had in place mobile health vans. Our van that gets the most use is our mobile mammogram van. So imagine a huge RV that has a mammogram machine on it that goes out into communities all over 22 parishes in North and Central Louisiana, providing mammograms for women who live far enough away from a mammogram machine or center that they otherwise might not be able to get a mammogram. So these relationships have been in place for years, for almost 10 years, we've been providing mammograms to these communities. So you can imagine as the pandemic began and everyone began to shelter in place and stay at home, and of course our healthcare system completely changed, screening mammograms for women who weren't currently having a problem, we were one of the first services to stop. So we had this wonderful van sitting there, not really doing much. But the testing really began with the founding of the new emerging viral threat lab at LSU Health System, which you may have heard of. So me on my own, I've got the van. Now right across the campus, we have this incredible groundbreaking lab that's making its own viral testing kits and is running the tests themselves. So the two sort of collaborated and got together, and we put that service onto this van that wasn't being used and began to target communities out in the rural areas and here in town to take testing to make it easy.
And from the standpoint of, you know, the unit, how is it staffed? Do we have doctors and nurses and technicians, the full spectrum of healthcare providers in the van?
No, not actually. We do have a driver who's an employee of our Partners in Wellness system. The people who collect the specimens are actually nurses that are employed by the viral threat lab itself. So they've been trained to collect specimens, and they are very quick and efficient and can do an unbelievably amount of tests in a short amount of time. So that's really who goes out on the van. The rest of the event itself is actually this fantastic collaboration between everyone from the National Guard or local law enforcement who helps with traffic, We bring testing kits and testers out on the van. And then we also have another member of the collaboration team who is a clinic or a physician who has agreed to be the host of that event. So it's a fantastic teamwork thing. It's really, really fun. And everyone comes together, brings their A game, and it's really, really rewarding to have people come in, sometimes walking right across the street from their house up to the testing event and getting their COVID test done.
How is the National Guard actually assisting with mobile testing?
They've been completely invaluable. So you may be aware that the National Guard was involved in the state COVID testing effort pretty early on, and there have been testing events in different parts of town that the National Guard has been involved in that were not specifically LSU events. We had the benefit early in our mobile testing experience of working, having the Guard assist us, and they're just fantastic. They come in and do the things that I'm not trained to do. They bring traffic cones and they look at the safety and the parking lot and where are we going to enter? Where are we going to exit? And just an extremely organized and calming presence. Just their presence provides a degree of security to the event, which is, you know, huge event open to the public. So has been invaluable.
Which areas are you going to? And why is it important to have, you know, the availability in these outlying areas?
Sure. Well, some of the areas are actually what we would consider here in Shreveport to be inner city. And many of them are outlying too in Caddo Parish, as well as some other parishes across North Louisiana. So we know that COVID has taken an unusually severe toll on those in our community who have been underserved and who already suffer from health disparities and higher health chronic conditions. So COVID has accentuated those differences even more. And we know that African Americans have suffered worse outcomes in those of them who do get COVID in Louisiana. We've attempted to target communities both in and out of the city of people who we know struggle with things like transportation or maybe not having a physician that they can just pick up the phone and call and say, I need to talk to my doctor. I want to come in and get a COVID test. We've been to a variety of towns in and around North Louisiana. We've been to Haynesville and Minden and Gillum and Bastrop and Marion and all the way over to Tensaw Parish and down to Catahoula Parish. Here in town, we've been to the Cedar Grove neighborhood, the Moortown neighborhood, the MLK neighborhood, and Stoner Hill. We've been to Cherokee Park, and we've got events coming up at Caddo Magnet High School, Woodlawn High School. So good thing is that there's lots of community structure already in place where it's a good place to have an event if you can find a school that has an appropriate parking lot or a church that has an appropriate. In fact, today we were at Morningstar Baptist over on Joella.
How can people find out where you're going to be next?
So on our website, the LSU website, it's lsuhs.edu. There is a schedule of upcoming mobile testing events, and that's the best place to kind of keep up on where we're going to be.
Excellent information. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and we are discussing the COVID-19 pandemic. Our guest tonight, Dr. Keith Scott, Professor of Pediatrics, Surgery, and Medicine here at LSU Health in Shreveport, as well as Dr. Jennifer Singh, Assistant Professor of Internal Medicine at the Feisweiler Cancer Center, who is also enrolling patients in mobile testing and also performs lifestyle medicine. Dr. Scott, let's go back to the treatment side of things again. From the standpoint of the nitric oxide trial, we discussed patients who are more severe. You're looking at ventilator-dependent patients as well as patients who may be declining to that area. I know you mentioned that it was safe. Do you have any early results yet to share with our listeners?
excuse me. I wish I did. However, looking at the way patients respond to nitric oxide and also the difficulty we have getting them off nitric oxide, there's something happening. And unfortunately, we don't have the data yet. We're getting close. but I'm extraordinarily encouraged. And what makes me so excited about this therapy is almost all hospitals of any size, maybe greater than 200 beds, have one of these ventilators, have that gas, and they can give it starting right now. There are no regulatory stumbling blocks. There's no way to prevent this from going on. In fact, I get calls from all over the country saying, what are you doing? I said, well, we're doing this, but it's in a trial. They said, no, we're going to do it. And so there may be a lot of retrospective looking at this too. So we have this prospective trial, but there may be a lot of retrospection trials or papers looking back and said, we did it. We mocked your trial and let's see how this comes out. So it's going to be an interesting couple of months, but we're very encouraged because if this does what we think it's doing, it's a game changer.
Now,
it's not a silver bullet, but it's a game changer.
Now, are both of these trials randomized controlled trials where you're giving a sham treatment or a placebo?
They are.
And then the other thing is...
But a lot of centers... a lot of centers are mimicking our trial, and we're going to have to figure out a way to look at that too, because that's readily available, information. So they're just mimicking. So we got to figure out a way how to, look at their data too and marry it with our data to figure out how this thing may work.
And you mentioned, the Data Safety Monitoring Board, and if for, our listeners out there who may not be as acquainted with clinical trials, this is a group that actually looks at the data in an unblinded fashion. And correct me if I'm mistaken, Dr. Scott, if there's a significant effect, trials are actually stopped, right? And you move on.
Absolutely.
as a concluded trial based upon efficacy results. And so it's not like, if a patient's enrolled in the trial, there's a huge risk of getting worse because they're not receiving the drug. That's why we need to do this important research.
And we've been looked at twice by the data set, the data monitoring board, and they both time said, keep the trial going. It's safe.
From the standpoint, and this is a little bit, more into the clinical research side of things, we know how nitric oxide works in terms of pulmonary blood flow. Are you looking at viral loads in patients to determine, if there is a beneficial effect, if it's going to be attributable directly to either inflammatory markers or viral loads as opposed to oxygen exchange and pulmonary, hemodynamics?
Actually, we are, and I appreciate you asking that question because we just got approved last week and then, of course, on Monday for the other trial to start doing biomarkers. And we're actually going to start doing biomarkers not only on our patients, but also probably from Mass General and maybe UAB, so that we can start looking at some of these inflammatory markers. Because it's one thing to say clinical, it's actually, if you can back it up with something biologic, it certainly enhances, your argument that it's a good therapy. So we now draw blood on patients at 2-4 and so many days after, and we're running that through Dr. Steve Alexander's lab at LSU and other things through the emerging the viral threat lab. So we're excited about this, and what I'm so excited about is, we're some of the first in the country to really put this under an umbrella of, we got to fight this as a group, not as an individual lab here, there, everywhere. We're fighting this as a group. So I'm very proud of our system.
Excellent information. From the standpoint of other treatments, I understand, you know, the treatment considered a convalescent plasma is becoming available. Tell us a little bit about what is convalescent plasma. There's a lot of discussion going on now about antibody testing and whether or not antibodies are perfected, you know, effective, and who should be tested for antibodies, and if they're positive, who should give convalescent plasma, or if that's being recommended as a treatment?
Well, a lot of places, actually all around the country, are giving convalescent plasma. And what convalescent plasma is if you've had the disease, then you should have developed antibodies. And those antibodies are in your plasma. So when you give blood or blood donation, we can sift out your plasma and hopefully those antibodies with it. And then we can give it to a patient that doesn't have antibodies and hope it works. The problem is we don't know yet. You know, there's anecdotal data, but we don't know. And we're in a study with Mayo Clinic right now, looking at this to see if this actually will be beneficial. We think it will, but the problem is we don't know if having antibodies means you're immune or means you're resistant. As I talked to you earlier, I had COVID-19 6 weeks ago, 5 days, high fevers. It's taken me a month to get over it. I have zero antibodies, which is disappointing because I wanted to donate them, but unfortunately I didn't. And even if you have antibodies, we're still not sure, does that somehow make you immune? And this is the problem with this virus medically, is we're doing this on the fly. We just don't have a way not to do it on the fly. And so we're doing the best we can. We're you know, working, but it's just going to take a while to figure out exactly what works and doesn't work.
Yeah, I've got some follow-up to that. Let me give the number again, 1-800-552-8502 if you have questions about COVID-19. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. Dr. Keith Scott is our guest tonight with LSU Health Center Professor of Pediatrics, as well as Dr. Jennifer Singh with LSU Health with the Feistweiler Cancer Center. Dr. Scott, again, with regards to antibodies, you know, as a physician, my thought is, if you got the disease, it's an infectious disease, it's a viral disease, and you recovered, and you had obviously an immune response to the disease, and you were tested for your immune response, it's not that you didn't get, you know, you didn't have an immune response, we just missed it. That the test didn't find, you know, your evidence of your immune response and recovery. Could it be that our antibody test doesn't catch everyone who's recovered from the disease?
I think that's absolutely right, because you know, you could have a T cell response which doesn't make antibodies, but it does give you immunity. And so this is what we're trying to tease out from this, which is why antibody testing is so important, because when you see someone that obviously had it, had the syndrome, had a positive, and they don't make antibodies, well, let's look deeper. Let's look deeper into their cellular line and see exactly, maybe they have an immunity that's much deeper than just antibodies. And what is unique about our labs are we're looking at that. We're deep diving into this.
And it'll be interesting to see if maybe an RNA-based vaccine might have more potential than perhaps a protein-based vaccine, if that's the case, if some patients need cellular immunity to recover versus what we call humoral immunity.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, everyone's so cautious about vaccines. There's a reason, is vaccines can be harmful, and they can actually make you worse. So we have to be very careful about how we walk down the vaccine road and make sure we understand all the mechanisms and how this virus affects the immune system. Because if we attack one side and forget the other side, then we've lost the battle.
Dr. Singh, from the standpoint of testing, if someone wants to come to the mobile health unit and have testing for COVID-19, what symptoms should they have, or do they need symptoms? And do they get viral testing, or do they get antibody testing, or both?
There we go. I'm so sorry.
There you go.
Randall, can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you for coming.
Sorry,
back.
Dr. Burr. So, yes. So the guidelines on who should get tested have really evolved and changed at a lightning pace throughout the pandemic. And recently, just a few weeks ago, the CDC opened the guidelines even more on who should be tested to now include, of course, people with symptoms. And the highest priority is people who are healthcare workers or live in a group facility or any first responders. But now that's been opened up to even people without symptoms who the state government or the local public officials think that they should be tested even just for public health monitoring. So, you know, you mentioned going into communities that might be at higher risk. Most of the communities or some of the communities that we choose, we actually choose them because there is such a low number of COVID cases in that neighborhood. We are concerned that, are we just not seeing anything because nobody's getting tested? And should we go there and test?
What's your experience so far? Are you finding that there are more positives than you would suspect based on prevalence of cases coming from certain communities?
No, not especially. That's not what we're finding at all. In fact, our emerging viral threat lab, the EVT lab, has finding that our rates in general that they are performing, now this is not just specifically from our van, but all of the tests that our viral lab is performing, they've performed well over 10,000 tests at this point. And you mentioned earlier, we were talking before the show, that different places in the United States have had different percentages of positives. And we find that we are less than 10% in our positives in who we're choosing. And who we're testing.
And nationally, the percent positivity rate is trending downward. Are we finding that to be the case in our community as well?
Well, on some days, in general, some days, yes, and some days, no. But that does tend to vary a little bit because of things like how many specimens reach a lab on a certain day. Versus sometimes, in other words, it's logistics and it's difficult to tell if, well, today we had an increase. Were these tests actually drawn last week? Is this a data that's actually reflecting what's happening on the ground today? So overall, we're feeling confident that in our region, we have flattened the curve, that we thankfully that everything that we attempted to do worked, that the rates are at a level where we're definitely not out of the woods completely. It's not like COVID has disappeared. Everyone should continue to please wear your mask, wash your hands, social distance. If you have chronic conditions, please don't go out any more than you need to. And the good news is that these things work. And so luckily, and I think Dr. Scott can back me up on this, in our area, and especially at LSU, we didn't ever get to the point where there wasn't a ventilator available. We didn't get to the point that there was not room for patients or these terrifying stories that we heard in other areas. So we are encouraged that what we've done works. We need to keep following the directions on the reopening and be cautious. And hopefully, as we continue to test, again, we frequently choose our testing areas, not because there's been a lot of cases there, but because we've not seen cases there and we're concerned that they haven't had access to testing in that area. So
again, are you providing both antibody and viral testing?
No, we're not doing any antibody testing at all. Just viral testing. We're doing the nasal swabs. And I believe you actually asked me if they had to have a doctor's order. Did you ask me that? Or how they would? So you don't have to come with a doctor's order. However, one critical piece that I failed to mention is that we've been partnering with federally qualified health centers who essentially act as sort of like the clinic host for that site. And they have very generously If you walk up or drive up, and even if you're not a patient at that clinic, they will register you for the day as their patient after they discuss with you and make sure that it's appropriate for you to get tested and sign you up as their patient for the day. The results will return to that provider or that doctor, and they will notify you about your test result. They sort of adopt you for the day as a patient and provide an order for you.
Excellent information. And you mentioned the social distancing, and we're going to get back to that after we go back to Dr. Scott here for a moment. Before that, we're going to remind our listeners you can call with questions or comments about this topic tonight, which is, again, the COVID-19 pandemic here in Louisiana in our community. The number for calls or questions regarding this topic is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. So, Dr. Scott, you mentioned that you had a personal experience with COVID-19. Tell us, how was that experience for you? What made you think that? How did it start?
Well, I woke up one morning and my wife has leukemia, so we have actually, because I work in the hospital, I slept in my RV, and she slept in the house. We have some land, so it's feasible. And I woke up one morning and with the worst muscle aches I've ever felt in my life, high fever. And I traveled to Africa a lot for some health missions. And I've had typhoid from Africa. It's nothing compared to this. This was the worst thing I've ever felt in my life. And I knew I had it, but I couldn't get tested. And I had to, that happened to me on my Thursday. I couldn't get tested until the Monday because there was no testing available in our community. Finally, I got tested and I came back positive. And, it was just, it's taken me really a month and a half to get over it. Just the fatigue. Fortunately, I never had a respiratory issue. It was muscle aches, fatigue. And that's the weird part about this virus is this phenotype is so different with so many people. Some it's respiratory, some it's GI. Some like me, it's just fatigue, which makes it so hard to diagnose or to try to pin down, did you have it? Don't you have it? But eventually I got swabbed and I was positive. Isolated myself, got over it. And, fortunately, thank the Lord, I recovered just with fatigue. A lot of people I know that got it, got respiratory symptoms, other issues, and have not been as fortunate as I am. So it's very personal to me.
And you're in the healthcare system. Are you seeing, and you mentioned a lot of the people that you know that had the disease had respiratory symptoms. Are we seeing that there was a high incidence of infection in healthcare workers here locally?
Not necessarily. It's just, I think just the standard distribution. And we have done these models. Actually, we did a model back with H1N1, where we realized that 20% of healthcare workers will get this infection and can't go back to work. So a lot of people, I don't think, realize that when this pandemic hits, definitely hit the community, hits the healthcare community. So you lose 25% of your healthcare workers automatically. So now you've dropped your volume that you can handle by 25%. And I think that's, what I'm seeing is a lot, and I'll give me as an example. All I had to do was be 72 hours without a fever and I could go back to work. And I did. And that's what all these healthcare workers are doing. They shouldn't be. They should be resting. They should be recovering. But they went back to work. And I just, I think it's a remarkable story, the way this community in Northwest Louisiana has really gathered around this process and really said, we're going to beat it in our community.
From the standpoint of, you know, you're enrolling patients in clinical trials, you mentioned, you know, different varieties of the disease. Do you expect our cases to start going up? What are you seeing in terms of enrollment in clinical studies and symptomatic patients? Are we, I know we flattened the curve, so to speak, but if the curve is flat, but the number of tests we're doing is significantly higher, it makes us makes me wonder, are we really flat?
I think we're flat, but we're about to hit a second surge. And that's just the nature of any virus. And I think we have to be prepared for that, which is why I still encourage people to wear a mask, do social distancing. Opening up doesn't mean the virus is gone. It just means we are opening up so that we can have a little more liberty, but we still have to be responsible. And remember, you know, it doesn't take much for this virus to touch someone else. So just putting on a surgical mask, we know now there was a study just released yesterday. A simple surgical mask will stop 95% of COVID. A simple surgical mask. It doesn't have to be an N95. So just please do that. Just please do that when you go to Home Depot. Please do that when you go to Brookshire's. It's what you can do for your neighbor.
Yeah, I mean, the almost, you know, on, you know, instantaneous reporting of those types of studies has been remarkable. I think another study was recently published that 8 minutes in the air, right? If you have COVID and you cough and you don't have a mask right on, even if you're not symptomatic, maybe you sneeze or you're at choir practice, it doesn't matter. It's in the air. It's aerosolized, and it's not going away for 8 minutes. So you can leave the building and somebody coming in after you, 6, 8, 20 feet apart, walks through that aerosol, they potentially get COVID-19 if they're not wearing a mask, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I unfortunately had a person in front of me the other day that had a mask on. I was 6, maybe 8 feet away in line at the grocery store and said, you know, I'm not going to give you anything. And I said, I'm sorry, I work in a COVID unit. I'm not going to give you anything. And that's why I wear a mask. And I think we have to be that socially responsible. It's not what you're preventing also. It's also what you're preventing the other person from getting. So we have to be socially responsible. And that doesn't mean distancing as much as just put on a mask. It ain't that hard.
You know, you mentioned you expected our cases to start going up, and you're a pediatrician. And so the next major thing that we really need to figure out as a community, and obviously we have public health officials that will guide the way, but we've got this mysterious Kawasaki-like disease that's, you know, affected case report levels of children, you know, across the country. But I think the bigger issue for the pediatric population are these spreading and shedding phenomena. What's your take on the pediatric population, and as an extension of that, you know, getting back to in-person learning, which so many of our students really need to get back to? But, you know, that's what we're hearing. Online learning is for, you know, some populations, but you know, you can't really get as much, especially in the younger crowd, from that. So what's your take on, number one, the pediatric disease, pediatric shedding and spreading, and when do we determine when and how to return back to in-person learning, back to school?
Well, I'll tell you it's called PMIS now. There's several names, but it's pediatric multisystem inflammatory syndrome. And we're seeing this post-COVID. And again, like you said, it acts like Kawasaki's. And for the listeners that don't know what that is, that is basically the blood vessels to the heart dilate. The heart itself gets sick, and it's like a three-year-old getting a heart attack. It's very devastating, can be devastating. And what we're seeing, they have 85, 86 cases in New York as of this morning. 25 states have reported this. 17 countries have reported the same syndrome. So when everyone says, you know, it doesn't affect kids, it does. It just does it in a different way. You know, fat people like me, we get respiratory, but these children, this is a delayed response, and we have to pay attention to this. So I'm hoping that school can go back, but I think, you know, another month or two, we'll have a little better handle on this. But my recommendation right now is if this thing spreads among kids and we have this delayed response, it'll be devastating, because the problem is what we're seeing with this PMIS is, I mean, mortality rates of 20, 25%. So it's an enormous problem that we have to pay attention to. So my recommendation is, let's hold off on getting back to school till we figure this thing out and say, is it just post? Okay, people are going to get it, they got it. We can go back to school, or is this something we can spread and spread and spread? I think it's going to take probably another month to figure that out. And I think it's worth the wait.
This is listener-supported Red River Radio. You're listening to Health Matters. Our topic tonight is the COVID-19 pandemic. Our guests are Dr. Keith Scott, Professor of Pediatric Surgery and Medicine here at LSU Health in Shreveport, and Dr. Jennifer Singh, Assistant Professor of Internal Medicine and Lifestyle Medicine Practitioner here in practice at the Feisweiler Cancer Center. Dr. Singh, you know, back to social distancing, you mentioned that as an important part of preventing the spread of COVID-19. In your mobile testing unit, you've got the unique ability that many healthcare providers don't get in terms of seeing what people are actually doing out in communities. What are you finding in terms of are people wearing masks? Are they staying socially distanced? What's it been like for you?
Well, what I've been able to see is what people are doing in their cars. So we only do, well, that's not true. We don't only do. The majority of people that we have tested out at our events get to remain in their car. We do always have walk-ups, and we have places where people can just walk up if they prefer to just walk in from the neighborhood. What I've seen is I've been very encouraged to see that definitely greater than 97% of the people that have come through at the testing events, and so far at the testing events, that's over 1,000 people, and the very, very few of them are not already wearing masks when they drive up in their car. So I've been really encouraged to see that the public is showing up to these events, and they're wearing a mask, so that's great. We actually had, we've distributed over 750 quarantine kits for people who have shown up at our inner city and rural areas to get tested. So a quarantine kit is just a Ziploc bag that has two masks, a hand sanitizer, and some hand soap, along with a really nice, just a brief review handout. Here's the basics. It's actually pretty simple, but wash your hands, stay apart. If you find out you're positive, here's how you can protect your family inside your house. So we were able to give away, like I said, over 700 quarantine kits so far. We have had some trouble with sourcing masks. We ran out of cloth masks. So if anyone is still masking, I know initially when the pandemic began, there were so many people who were helping out in that respect. And we are actually now realizing that it's not just healthcare workers who need masks. For us to reopen, as Dr. Scott was talking about the importance of just a plain surgical mask, it's important for everyone in the community to kind of have their own stash, to have their own little stash of masks. So if you're interested in helping us out with some cloth masks, you can go to the LSU Health Shreveport Facebook page and send a message, and that will be answered.
Yeah, it's really quite a phenomenon. You go and you see there's LSU masks, there's Cowboys masks, there's Saints masks, there's all different types of designs out there. And, you know, as Dr. Scott just mentioned, you know, a simple surgical mask, which is not that much more complicated than the cloth mask that you can make out of just about any material, 95% efficacy in preventing the spread of this virus. So that's, I mean, that's an amazing number. Dr. Singh, from the standpoint of the people that you are seeing that are coming for testing, are you analyzing what percentage of those are coming because they have characteristic COVID-19 symptoms versus, the phenomenon of asymptomatic, shedding of the virus, which is obviously something that we worry a great deal about?
Sure. Well, I'm personally not the one who's the ordering doctor, so I'm not doing the individual evaluations on each patient. There is another doctor who's actually the one whose staff is doing the registration, asking them about their symptoms. But just from being there and seeing these hundreds and hundreds of patients come through, I don't have the actual data, but the vast majority of them either have no symptoms or very mild symptoms. Most of them are there because they are worried, because they are trying to be responsible. They've got children in their family or older people in their family. Many of them may be concerned that someone that they knew had it. They may have a feared exposure. So they have a lot of reasons. Many of them just want to know. But in general, the vast majority of them don't have severe symptoms for sure. And that luckily we've not had to sort of emergently tell someone, you need to go to the doctor right now, to the ER right now. We have not had to do that. And again, that's another point. You can definitely come get tested if you have mild symptoms. But if you have symptoms, you really should talk to your own doctor or the doctor at the event to make sure that it's safe for you to simply get tested and go home.
And now the coordinating clinic, are they coordinating with the Louisiana Department of Health to provide, prevalence data as well as contact tracing once the test results are available?
Sure. So because COVID is a reportable disease in Louisiana, every provider lab who is dealing with COVID cases is reporting everything to the Louisiana Department of Health. So, yes.
Excellent information. From the lifestyle medicine perspective, do you have any tips on staying healthy during the pandemic? I'll give you a second to put your other hat on. In terms of, eating habits, it's been hard to get out and exercise.
Sure.
People are anxious about, having to isolate, and everybody's ready to get back to normal. And I know we have to be cautious about that. From the lifestyle medicine perspective, what tips could you give folks out there?
Well, as you may have seen, everyone keeps kind of saying the same thing. If you have chronic conditions and if you're at higher risk, please be even more careful. And we all assume that, of course, the most common chronic condition that would put someone in danger from COVID would be lung disease, right? If you've got bad emphysema or bad asthma or maybe a problem with your immune system. So what's been really surprising is to see that people who have other chronic conditions that are extremely common also are having worse outcomes if they contract COVID. And one of those is high blood pressure. That it's turned out that that's actually a risk factor to be more severely ill if you contract COVID. So yes, I do believe that the science shows us that there are things that we can do to stay healthy. And in truth, it's kind of the intensive application of common sense, fresh air, movement, and as much fruit and vegetable as you can get your hands on actually have measurable improvements in our body weight, the blood pressure, getting outside to get plenty of air and plenty of oxygen regulates our mood, and mood disorders have been a problem during this time of social isolation. So all of the things that doctors have been telling us to do for our health for quite some time are actually even more important now. So some source of social connection and relaxation, whether that's prayer or meditation or reading books to help with mood, lots of fruits and vegetables, time outside if you can get outside and remain socially distanced.
I'm Dr. Randall Brewers, and that's our show for this evening. You can find more information on COVID-19 at coronavirus.gov. This program will be available for podcast at www.redriverradio.org. You can also find updates on COVID-19 for Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas on our homepage. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Thanks to Kermit Poling and Wally Derleth for providing assistance this evening. Views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not reflect those of the station, LSUS, or its staff. Health Matters has been made possible in part by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for being part of our audience this evening. And turn in next Thursday as we continue our special Health Matters coverage on the COVID-19 pandemic.
When the war is over, we go back to every day, every day. Will it be the same again? When you've been turned inside out and outside in, sing it from the windows. Shadows on the wall, the way they dance. It's not much or nothing. But look at this fire burning bright. Look at how the children play. None of us know what's to come tomorrow, but I'm not going out today. So dance with me like the time we've got is borrowed, yeah. Sing it from the windows. Sirens outside, where are you going? Pretend that it's nothing. Look at this fire burning bright. This is how we keep holding on all the days, all day long. But sometimes things just fall apart. No matter how we try, they won't stop. Sing it from the window. And I don't know when the storm is over, and we go back to every day, every day. Memories in picture frames, trying to put the inside out and the outside in. Sing it from the window. Walking down the hall, nowhere to go. Be good to see you. But I suppose when it's all said and done, this is how we keep holding on all the days, all day long. But sometimes things just come apart. No matter how we try, they won't stop. Sing it from the windows. Voices outside and